It's like Orbit Sweet Mint.
Sweet Mint is my favorite flavor of gum.
I feel like it's everyone's favorite, but Bubble Mint was good too.
Oh my God, yeah. Oh my God.
Actually, just really Orbit good. Slayed the house down. We got Spearmint, Bubble Mint, and Sweet Mint.
Yeah.
Like between those three, like you could be set for fucking life.
Oh, I only buy Orbit. Also, the texture can't be beat. Nice and soft.
Original Trident.
Yeah.
That has a good, like, you bite into it. It's just like soft. It's not like chalky. It's just like, hush. It's just like biting into a pillow. But the pillow is memory foam.
Oh, it is.
That's what it is.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of Poor Unfortunate Podcast. I'm Caroline Ametti.
And I'm Connor Perkins. Welcome to any old listeners. It's great having you with us again. To any new listeners, thank you for joining us. If you haven't already, hit follow or subscribe wherever you're listening to the podcast. That way all of our episodes download right to your device. You don't miss out on anything. And then when you get to the end of the episode, make sure that you leave a 5-star rating and a review if you liked what you heard. It helps other people find the podcast. We're seen in search results, all that good stuff. And to our existing listeners, if you haven't done that, you know I always make a mention of that in here. So please just do that. But yeah, there's some new stuff happening. So Caroline, what's new?
I'm going to have to jump to the news that's hot off the presses today as we record this.
Spicy off the press.
Oh my gosh. And that it's that it is confirmed that Princess Diaries 3 is indeed in the works.
God bless America.
It was reported.
God bless Julie Andrews.
Yes, it was reported by Hollywood Reporter, Variety. So it's confirmed. No word on Anne Hathaway. No word on Julie Andrews. Obviously, I think they've both expressed interest. But yeah. It did say in the Variety article that it is not a reboot. It is a continuation of the same story. So that gives me so much hope and excitement. I was just talking about it with actually one of our lovely listeners and friend, Isabel. We were just talking about how it's time, and poof, there it was. If we were doing Christmas wish list this year, I just got one of my wishes.
I feel like it's a matter of time, given Hocus Pocus 2, Sister Act 3 is confirmed now, Disenchanted.
Yeah.
It was a matter of time, and I feel like everyone was hoping for it. Literally, every question that Julie Andrews got when she was just awarded with, I forget what she was just awarded with, but like
probably
everybody's question
every
on
week.
The carpet was like, it was a Lifetime Achievement Award, and everyone was like, are you doing Princess Diaries 3? And she's like, I would love to, but I can't imagine what they would do. She's Queen Claire.
Literally
so
anything.
Old. And
anything.
I'm like, I don't care.
It could be the two of them like eating dinner and I would watch it.
But I'm so glad that we're getting that.
Yeah.
And then I guess in the same spirit of that, Disenchanted, by the time you're hearing this episode, will have already come out on Disney
wait.
Plus. It looks so good. The little glimpses that we keep getting of it
yeah.
is just so good.
Yeah.
So good.
Can't wait. And, you know, things come and things go. So it was announced that the Pirates of the Caribbean film starring Margot Robbie is scrapped. I actually didn't read too much into it. Do you know why? I'm assuming money?
I don't know why, but there are a lot of people thinking that it's going to end up being a Disney Plus series.
Oh, well.
Because they're trying desperately to make Disney Plus profitable.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Chapek is convinced that it will be profitable by 2024. And so he keeps putting the same budget. I think it was like a $30 billion budget into Disney Plus this past year. And he's, I think, confirmed another $30 billion for next year.
So I could do with a Pirates series. I could.
I'd be
I would take it.
I'd be down for it. That would be cool. Especially to have a female-led
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, Bob Chapek, we always have a little something to say about him. So
yeah, we do.
So, you know, there were a couple of articles that came out this past week about Disney numbers and, you know, just the financial state of Disney and folks continuously calling for Bob Chapek to be fired, which is not going to happen. I read this interesting article on Walt Disney World News today, which I think gave a really nice perspective.
Take them with a grain of salt, though.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Gave nice perspective, though, in that it's like the problem is, and it's the conundrum that we discuss all the time, which is we don't feel right about so many of the things that happen. And then, for example, you'll see when you go to Disney, like I was like, oh, I'm so against, you know, Genie Plus and Lightning Lanes and money on money on money. And I got swooped into spending it. And the person who wrote the article was like, you know, at some point, the only thing that's going to talk is money. Like, if we all cancel our Disney Plus subscriptions and we refuse to, like, buy the Lightning Lanes, which is nearly impossible to do, maybe some things will change. But that is and they acknowledge this in the article as well. It's just so much easier said than done. And they brought up the popcorn buckets and just all of these things that we just go along with. I will say it's interesting to think about the Galactic Star Cruiser and how folks are not paying up for that. So maybe that's a step in the right direction in terms of people saying enough is enough.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, I mean, as far as Disney Plus goes, Disney Plus is something that I really love, but it's also something that Bob Iger was really pushing for. Like, that was his baby, and Bob Chapek is still putting all of his eggs in that basket because streaming is very difficult right now in this market to make profitable. It's something that, like, all of the streaming networks have battled with in their first like 5 years of existence. And it's something that I don't want them to divest from Disney Plus. I don't want Disney Plus to go away because it's actually something that is one of the few things that's allowing the magic to sort of be everywhere.
Very
like, now I have the entire library of Disney at my fingertips whenever I want it, whenever I need it. So like, that's actually something that doesn't feel wrong for me, but monetarily, like, it's not
what
going
if for
the way
just
that they
one
want
week
to.
1 week we all cancel it then we'll all go
I'm
back
just afraid that, I'm just afraid that they would, like, if we go too, it's sort of like the situation of, like, if you go too hard in one direction, then they just, like, cancel shit.
Yeah.
And it's like,
right,
well, that's
right.
Not really what you wanted them to
yep,
do.
Yep, yep.
You wanted them to pay attention. It's just it's a tricky situation.
It is.
But the earnings call from the last quarter was not, the numbers were not where they were expecting in terms of stocks and the value in Disney stock and everything like that, which is leading Bob Chapek to be making some quote unquote tough decisions moving forward in the Disney company, including a hiring freeze and probably cuts of, you know, budgets to different things and individual positions as well, which is always unfortunate to hear. Because, you know, it's jobs that we're talking about and it's jobs around the holidays, too. It's like the same shit that's happening at Twitter right now. I'm like, all these people are losing their jobs right before Christmas.
No, I know.
Like,
I know.
It's fucking bullshit. But it's this difficult thing. And right now on Disney Twitter and everything, everyone's trying to, like, radically simplify it. And they're like, oh, it's all because of Bob Iger's Fox deal that all this is happening. I'm like, there's a lot of things. You're not going to be able to just point to like one thing and say, this is why this is all happening. It's that, it's the pandemic. It's a change in culture. It's the rise of other streaming networks. It's like a million different things all happening. And it's unfortunate. And I don't know what the answer is, but it just sucks. And I always try and focus in on the people that are going to be affected by this. And just trying to put out as much sympathy and love and energy
absolutely,
or whatever and support to those people, because like that's where it's going to be needed. And I don't know what the future of Disney is going to be. None of us do. And none of us are really going to be a part of those decisions. What we can do is what Caroline, you were saying, is just sort of try and direct our wallets in the direction of where we want the company to go. And it's difficult and it's painful, but like it's kind of what you gotta do. And it's frustrating when this is coming after a year of Disney raising prices in the parks, bringing in like record profits in the parks division, and it's still quote unquote underperforming. And I'm like, how is this happening? You went to charging every single person $25 for something that was free and took away the free transportation and And how I don't understand. Like,
yeah. And
I don't understand.
On all of the articles about the Galactic Star Cruiser, so many people have commented, I'm actually dying to go on the Star Cruiser, but, you know, $5,000 for 2 days is not doable for me. They were like, I'm not expecting it to be cheap, but that's unattainable. So what is Disney going to do? I'm so curious to see what they're going to do. Are they going to bite the bullet and slash the prices? Or I could, the way things are right now, I could see them closing the damn Star Cruiser. I'm not even going to lie to you.
I could see them closing Star Cruiser. I could see them just stopping putting money into the parks right now, to be completely honest, because right now we're proving that we'll sit through misery. I don't think that that's going to last. And I think that that's going to come back to bite them in the butt in the way that all of this is biting them in the butt, because kind of what I talked about, was it last episode where I was talking about how they're just looking at all these short-term growth, which when the long-term comes around, starts biting them in the ass. And this is some of that focus biting them in the ass now in the long-term. And
yet you see the pictures of the parks as you were texting me on a Monday in November. Absolutely jammed.
And 15 attractions had waits over an hour.
There was a line to even get inside the Mexico Pavilion, just to get inside. It's just wild.
I don't know. But this kind of leads into another thing that happened today with the parks, where in Walt Disney World, they're introducing a one park, one day ticket, which will range from over $120 a ticket to as much as $189 per ticket. And that's for one day in one park.
Dude.
Sort of like a one-off ticket. And the $189 ticket would be during like the Christmas to New Year's week, which is ironically when I'm going. And I'm just like, so people are going to pay $189 to what? Go into a park where they can't do anything? And they also announced that they raised prices for the annual passes in Walt
that
Disney
you can't
World,
buy.
Which aren't even on sale right now. You can't get them except for the one pass that's like not even great.
Please.
It's a bit of a mess.
Every time we record, I'm like, you know what? We won't talk about this, but there's always something new. There's always something new. So we'll end this news segment on a nicer note that will also segue nicely into the episode, which is that The Lion King on Broadway just celebrated its 25th anniversary. 25.
Yeah.
And they released the most heart-wrenching commercial that you simply must see. We put it in our stories. It was absolutely beautiful, and it proves like multiple generations have been able to see the show, bring their own children. It's amazing.
It's the longest running Disney theatrical.
Yeah, you just love to see it. It's so interesting. I wonder if they would have thought that when it opened, because it was a little bit more.
I think they
would
have picked Beauty and the Beast as
a little bit more experimental than Beauty and the Beast was. So you know, it's just interesting. Yeah. So let's segue into the episode on that.
Yeah, let's go into it.
And I don't think we were even aware of this when we chose this topic, but we are going to focus our showdown. We are back at our showdown episode around Disney on Broadway, and more specifically to Disney on Broadway original cast recordings.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know, a soundtrack, that is what it goes with a movie or goes with a TV show. It's sound and music that is laid down that remains the same from show to show. On Broadway, we get original Broadway or original off-Broadway or original London cast recordings, because it is a preservation and acknowledgement of one performance of the show, knowing that the show is going to sound a little bit different every single night. So it's not trying to say, this is what you're going to hear every single night. This is a version of the show that will give you an idea of it.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Important distinction.
It is.
One
it
acknowledges
is.
The humanity.
This is a
of
theater
it.
Nerd thing that you must know. Yeah.
It is. It is.
This is the perfect intersection of all the things that me and Connor love. It gets Disney and musical theater.
I used to be a person who would be like, oh, why do people get so hung up on it? But as I've gotten older, and
but isn't that how it always goes? When you get older, you're like, well,
into the theater community. And I'm like, no, it's actually really special that there is a distinction between the two.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, this being something we love so much, it was difficult for us to choose which two cast recordings we were going to compare.
So if you notice, we kind of put it up to you.
We did. We just asked, and we put a poll in the Insta stories to ask what everybody's favorite was, and it was close between Lion King and Beauty and the Beast, but Beauty and the Beast did take it away, and that's low-key probably our favorite as well. So there would be truly no point in putting that against anything else. So what we landed on is two shows that I think they're similar. Number one, they're, you know, Disney princess stories, Disney queen stories, but also two shows that I am sure Disney theatrical expected to run much longer on Broadway than they did. And those two shows are The Little Mermaid and Frozen.
And this is going to be a two-part episode because there is so much to talk about with these two cast recordings. This episode will cover The Little Mermaid, and next episode will drop in a week, and that is going to cover Frozen as well as our final thoughts. You're going to want to commit to this, so if you haven't listened to the Broadway cast recordings of The Little Mermaid or Frozen, those are available to you on YouTube, on Apple Music, on Spotify. So go ahead, take a moment to listen to both of those cast recordings now, and we will wait and meet you when you come back. And welcome back.
It never gets old.
Let's get into it.
So would we like to start with some background info on The Little Mermaid since it opened first?
Yeah, we always do. So let's do it. Let's make it happen.
All right. I got you. Let's go. So The Little Mermaid on Broadway. The Little Mermaid began previews on Broadway on November 3rd, 2007 and opened on January 10th, 2008. It replaced Beauty and the Beast at the Lundfontein Theater. The show had its out-of-town tryout at the Denver Center from July through September 2007, and it sold out. That's a huge theater, and it sold out pretty much every single seat during that out-of-town tryout. It ran on Broadway for 685 performances and 50 previews, closing on August 30th, 2009, so just about a year and 9 months on Broadway. This is a decent enough run for a Broadway show, but an extremely short one by Disney standards. The Little Mermaid was the fourth show on Broadway from Disney Theatrical after 2006's Tarzan, which ran for barely over a year, and before 2014's Aladdin, which is still running to this day in 2022. The Little Mermaid was directed by Francesca Zambello. This was her Broadway debut, her Broadway directing debut, after coming from the world of opera. The music is by Alan Menken, with music from the film, with lyrics from the late Howard Ashman, and new lyrics for the stage by Glenn Slater, who Menken had worked with on Home on the Range, and that's how he joined this project. Glenn would go on to write lyrics for Tangled, Sister Act, and the Phantom of the Opera sequel, Love Never Dies, which I did not realize. The book of the musical was written by Doug Wright, who had already won the Tony, Drama Desk, and Pulitzer Prizes for his play, I Am My Own Wife. And he wrote the book for the musical, Grey Gardens. The budget for the show, I read two different numbers, so somewhere between $15 and $16.6 million.
Jesus.
And the creative team for the show was as follows. Set design by George Sipin, lighting by Natasha Katz, costumes by Tatiana Noganova, and choreography by Stephen Muir. The cast included, among others, Sierra Boggess in her Broadway debut as Ariel, Sean Palmer as Eric, Sherry Renee Scott as Ursula, Norm Lewis as King Triton, Titus Burgess as Sebastian, Eddie Corbich as Scuttle, and Brian D'Addario as Flounder in the recording. The show was nominated for only two Tonys, for Best Original Score and Best Lighting Design of a Musical. Sierra, in my opinion, was robbed of a nomination, but she at least received a Drama Desk nomination for Outstanding Actress in a Musical, and the show received two additional nominations for Outstanding Set Design and Outstanding Lighting Design. The original Broadway cast recording was released on February 22, 2008 on Walt Disney Records. In March, so a month later, it ranked at number 26 on the Billboard 200 albums chart, the second highest position for a cast album in 25 years after Rent. And it was nominated for a Grammy for Best Musical Show Album. So, y'all know the story of The Little Mermaid. If you're here, we simply couldn't go over it again. But I just want to highlight some of the changes in the plot from the film to the show. So the biggest difference here is around the climax and how Ursula seeks to defeat Ariel at the end of the show. In the stage version, Ursula does not transform herself into Vanessa and bewitch Prince Eric. I remember when the show came out and I didn't see anybody listed in the cast as Vanessa. I was like, how? What's happening? So in the stage version, Eric is just simply too obsessed with the idea of finding the voice that has haunted him to see the woman he's falling in love with, Ariel, standing right in front of him. So, you know, the thing we're up against here is a little bit more human rather than magical. So Grimsby, who is in the show as well, arranges a singing contest in order for Eric to identify the voice that he's been searching for, which will end in the winner becoming his bride. Eric does not want any of the women who come to participate, and he asks Ariel to join in the contest. She dances for him, as he taught her to do earlier in the show, and just as he chooses her as the winner, Ursula appears to claim Ariel as the 3 days of the spell have ended. Like in the movie, Triton offers himself in her place, and Eric does arrive with his ship, but we do not get big, gigantic, blown-up Ursula in this version. Instead, Ariel grabs the Nautilus shell, which in this version of the story contains all of Ursula's powers, not just Ariel's voice. And she resists Ursula's attempts at persuading her to give it back and Ursula telling her she really can give her everything she's ever wanted. Ariel smashes the shell and it destroys Ursula.
Very Princess and the Frog.
Yes, indeed. It is very. So no Vanessa, no bewitching, no sea battle, no gigantic Ursula. Having seen the show, I can tell you, I very much miss those elements. And the climax deflates without them, or at least without a substitution of equal danger and stakes. But after the show closed on Broadway and plans for the tour were scrapped, there's a Dutch production that opened in 2012 that sought to correct some of the elements that weren't quite working from the Broadway production. And some of those changes affected the score. So Ursula's first number, I Want the Good Times Back, was replaced with Daddy's Little Angel, giving Ursula a new backstory in which we find out that she killed all of her sisters, but still lost the throne to her little brother Triton, and now wants to take what he loves most from him, just like she feels like he did to her. A huge improvement, but we will get there. This is the version of the show that is now licensed by Disney Theatricals, which also has the following changes. Human Stuff, one of Scuttle's songs, is cut. The World Above reprise, which King Triton sings in the Broadway cast recording, is cut for something called If Only, Triton's Lament. So it seeks to give him a little bit more sympathy, and then that means that the grotto destruction isn't happening along with a song. And the climax is also slightly improved, with Ursula revealing that she killed Ariel's mother. So just upping the stakes a little bit. I still don't know if that's enough to save the climax of the show, but that's not what we're focusing on today, so I will drop it. But basically, the summary here is these are a lot of the changes that I think probably should have happened before Broadway. But listen, it was successful out of town. They were probably very eager to get it to Broadway and get it making money. So that's how the cookie crumbles sometimes. So that's a little background information on The Little Mermaid.
All right, so we're going to be looking at these two cast albums. We're dividing it really into two different categories: the music that was adapted from the original film and additional music for the show, looking at what's working and what's not working in each of them. And then hopefully by the end, we're going to have a decision as to which cast recording is pulling it off better. So we're not going to dive too deep into like what's actually happening in these shows. We're trying to base it as much off of the album as possible.
I'm trying to focus here.
But there will be times that we probably have to bring in a little bit of what's happening in the show. So just know that and we'll give you an idea.
Okay, lovely. Yes, let's start with Little Mermaid.
Yeah, let's start with songs adapted from the film. Let's go through the positives first. And then we can go through some of the negatives.
All right. And please note, some of these, I'll start in a negative place and end in a positive place and vice versa. I have mixed feelings about some of these things. So
yeah,
I tried to categorize.
I mean, there are a lot of mixed reception, to be frank, about both of these shows from critics and fans alike.
Yeah. All right. Let's start on a positive note on the songs adapted from the film of The Little Mermaid. So I'm just going to start with the opening of the show, which is Fathoms Below, which is expanded from the animated film, of course.
It is.
But I enjoy it. This is another thing I forgot to note. In the version that is licensed out now, the show actually opens with The World Above, sung by Ariel, and then we go into Fathoms Below. I actually enjoy it opening with Fathoms Below. Number one, again, I'm going to try not to do this, but when the show opens, when I saw it, it opens on Prince Eric's giant-ass boat, and it's just a big wow moment, and I think building the anticipation of waiting to see Ariel is a nice idea.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the movie does.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Make us wait for it.
Make us wait for it.
The movie makes us wait for Ariel for a damn while.
It does. So, yeah, I enjoy this because it really, since it's the show opener, it really makes us less into the mythological background of the Merpeople. It's a nice way to ground the show from the very beginning. And like I said, from a production perspective, you know, the boat got its own round of applause when the show opened.
Yeah.
I think ground us in the world we're in. I think that raises the stakes as much as possible and then introduce us to the girl that we're all here to see. And it's just like, it's beautifully sung too. Very well sung.
Yeah, I said the same things about this. I really liked Fathoms Below, and I liked how even more was how Fathoms Below was also incorporated into the Storm at Sea sequence as well. I'm like, I think this is working, giving the people a chance to sort of characterize the knowledge of the land people's idea of the merfolk.
Yeah.
I think that's an asset. And I think that's also one of the things that you and I both latched onto in the Poor Unfortunate Souls book, the Twisted Tale book.
Yes.
Like anytime
yes.
we got more mythology on the merfolk of
we
what the human understanding was.
Yeah.
Because so much of the musical is going to be a mermaid's perspective of the human world that it's helpful to know what the human perspective is of the mer world.
And it just makes it so much more
if there
real.
Is one at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It makes it so much more realistic. It almost feels like two different nations almost and their ideas about each other, prejudice, all that stuff. It makes it more real and grounded, which I love.
Yeah.
Then I'm kind of going in the order, you know, of the tracks. And so then Part of Your World, just gloriously sung by Sierra Bogus.
Yep.
This version is a step higher than the key from the film. And although I think both keys are lovely, the place that it hits in Sierra's belt specifically, especially in when she sings Explore That Shore Up Above, I think was a really great contemporary adjustment. It gave her the opportunity to use a different sound than Jody Benson uses, and it feels even more powerful and full of longing, and it really gives me chills every time. And so then tied to that, the Part of Your World reprise, the option up at the end, oh my god, those vocals, like Sierra, I can't say enough good things about her. She really, this was her Broadway debut. She, like, went to the college that she went to, she chose because Jody Benson went there. Like, she was born to do this. But I think that she really raised the bar on Broadway for the belt mix.
Yeah.
It's just so, it's so healthy, but it's so powerful. And you can't have it, and you can't help but have it touch you right in the heart. It's, the key change, the option up. They're small changes that have huge impact. And I think that's what we really want to hear in an adaptation of a song that really is perfect.
Yeah. I'm like, they, for the most part, they didn't really change Part of Your World. And like, that's the right move. Just let Sierra fucking slay it. Like she
let
does.
Her slay it.
she let does. Her slay it.
And in that same vein, the
Under the Sea.
Yes. Oh. Yes.
Here we go. Titus, baby.
Oh my God. I was fortunate enough to see Titus sing this live, and he brought the house down. This is one of the thrills of a musical film to musical stage show adaptation. Just getting a performer who is like, watch me kick it up a notch when you thought it wasn't possible.
Yeah.
The kind of vocal gymnastics that he does during the whole song, but especially at the end, they're the perfect example of being called for by the song and the moment. He's trying to thrill Ariel with the life that she has. He genuinely loves, like, living under the sea. It's also just a huge party dance moment in the show. And so much belting and you know, skrelting on Broadway now feels unmotivated. And this fits perfectly in the moment. I also, even though they switched it back for the licensed version now, the placement of this song I actually enjoy in the original cast recording, which is after King Triton destroys the grotto. That's when Ariel's gonna need the most cheering up. Versus in the movie, it's like kind of because she's like kind of moping around and he's like, snap out of it. This is really feels like Sebastian really trying to reach out to her.
Yeah, there's from a caring place.
Yeah.
Because he's like, I know I have to make this better for her because
yeah,
she could do something really reckless if it doesn't work. And ultimately the tragedy of the song is it doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I mean, Titus will always be Sebastian to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I just remember seeing him, and it's just amazing to see where his career has gone, and he deserves it.
Yeah, with Under the Sea, I thought so many of the same things as you. I mean, I remember listening to an XM on Broadway interview with him when he talked about how the option up moment that he did where he slides into the skrelting.
Oh my
was something
God.
That
I know
he
exactly
did
what
in
you're
the rehearsal
about.
Room. And like Alan Menken's jaw dropped and everybody's jaw dropped and they were like, keep it. And it was just like something that came to him.
Oh my God.
But I think one of the things that's really strong about Under the Sea, in kind of a complete opposite to Part of Your World, is that it's more or less the same, but they did little things to keep us on our toes with it.
Mm-hmm.
Part of Your World, we want to hear it the way that it is. Under the Sea can afford moments to continually re-engage us as an audience because we already know what the song is. And they do that over and over and over again with the dance break. I mean, this version is just so surprising. I feel like every time you think you know what it is, something new happens in it. And I think one of the other great things about it is like just to really hear how the orchestra just slays this.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think Titus's Sebastian, he captures the integrity of the character, but we get to see his unique approach to it, which strengthens his version of the song. And I think that's why when you listen to like SiriusXM on Broadway, they will play this version of the song as opposed to the film version, which is not something they do with a lot of Disney theatricals. Like you listen to Beauty and the Beast, they will play Angela's version and not Beth Fowler's version.
Very true, yeah.
And it's because there was so much intention around Under the Sea to put in things that make it fresh, make it new, make it more exciting and surprising. And I think it really works.
That's what I have for positives. You got any other positives?
I do. I thought the Leposons in the stage version, I really liked it. Did you not like it?
Oh, yeah. It's good, but it wasn't enough for me to be like, this is a positive.
Oh, I had it as a positive because I was like, I felt like they pumped this thing up exactly the right amount. Like, it's a fun showstopper moment built out of a smaller moment from the film that worked really well on stage. And so I just think like the song itself has so much comedy and personality and characterization that it withstood them being able to stuff it up more and building it into a bigger version of itself. And so that played off to me really, really well. The other thing that I would say in here, which is kind of, it's in between, the Poor Unfortunate Souls reprise, which is not in the original, it's not in the film, but it's based off of the song. So I put it in here as a weird place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I actually think that this is a really good moment to have a substitute, in my opinion, for translating such a huge cinematic moment to the stage. Like in the film, you just go in for the big Ursula sequence, no problem, the second he signs the contract. But in theater, you have to sort of like take more time with it. If for nothing else, just to sort of like get tech shit together and that for like what your big, you know, fight sequence or like big action-y sequence is going
to
be.
If only there was more tech for them to prepare.
And that's the thing where I'm like, this could have sold really well if like she was growing as, like if tentacles were coming out over the theater as
or
she's
I feel like, again,
this.
I'm trying to focus here, but it's going to be hard. I feel like, in a way, I'm like, yeah, okay, on stage, we're not going to have her grow. That's fine. I feel like a pretty clear solution is to do something else with Vanessa, who is a human. Play up something where that is Ursula now. She's inside Vanessa. And just, I don't know.
I'm just like, how is it that Audrey 2 can attack a theater in every version of Little Shop of Horrors, but we can't grow Ursula's tentacles?
I know.
Into the house. Like, it's, we could have done that. We could have done that.
I know.
But I think this reprise serves us well in terms of also rounding out Ursula's plan that she sets in I Want Those Good Times Back, when she is saying that she's going to get Ariel and Triton with the same song. And now in the reprise, she's calling back and being like, I fulfilled both parts of my plan. I think that's good for story. And so I think that's why I have it as a positive.
Okay.
Now let's flip on to some of the negative adaptations that happened.
Yeah. I really only have one thing here, and it's minor. And I realize I actually talked about it as a positive for a moment. But with the Part of Your World reprise, even though I love Sierra's option up, she sounds beautiful. I compared the orchestrations from the film to this version, and the film orchestrations are so lush and dramatic in this moment. And they feel, and this is something I have to say about the orchestrations overall here, very simplified. Mm-hmm. There are a few other places where I feel like the orchestrations are just like more kid-friendly. The overall sound is far less mysterious than the sound of the film orchestrations. They feel more youthful. They feel, and I got so, when I saw the show in high school, I was all in. And I saw it with my mom. And her review after, what she did not enjoy. And she said that it felt like a theme park show. And it does, at times.
Girl, you tapping into my overall thoughts.
Yeah. And I'm trying to keep the production out of it. But the sound of the orchestra, even though they're slaying whatever they've been written, the orchestrations sound very simple, young, just like, you know, and we'll get there when it comes to Frozen. They were not doing what they did for Frozen, which is keeping in mind that a lot of the audience is going to be adults. It doesn't sound like that at all.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
very brass. It's like very brass heavy.
It's bright. It's brassy bright. And bright.
Where are the strings? Yeah. Oh, goodness. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, 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 yes. I'm going to talk about that. Mm-hmm. Some of my negatives, I brought in Daughters of Triton because they expanded upon the song from the film, but I think it's just really hokey the way that it was expanded. It feels like they're trying to get it to occupy more time for Sebastian's concert. But it's also not important enough. So it just feels like we're treading water and repeating itself as just sort of like a way to beef up the sisters' roles.
Okay.
It just sits in this strange place, especially because they take away the Ariel name reveal with her absence. Like, they make it through all of the names of the sisters and Ariel's not there. And then they introduce Ariel and she's not there and they're like, gasp. And so, like, part of the fun of that song is like they get ready to like beef up Ariel's moment and she's not there and it deflates on Ariel's name and then she pops up somewhere else. And by revealing Ariel's name just like casually in the song because we put another verse in, it takes the power away from that entire moment. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it felt like a silly decision that didn't need to happen. And then my other negative is I love Sherry Renee Scott. Love her. I love her as Ursula. This Poor Unfortunate Souls does not have the weight of Pat Carroll's. Part of that, I think, is in the orchestrations of it.
It's the orchestrations.
But also, it's in the script. It feels so desperate in the additional dialogue that they've peppered in throughout the song that it undercuts Ursula's power. Ursula is an octopus. They lay in wait and then snatch you when you're there. You come to them, and her dialogue that they've given her throughout the song is just doing a disservice to that. She's like trying to like beg you and like get you to do something and blah, 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 where that's not Ursula's way. She's like, hey, I'm just going to leave this piece of paper right here in a pen and you do you. Like, I'm fine, but like you do you. And the whole thing of Ursula is like, she sets the trap and lets Ariel spring it. And it feels like she's trying to set and spring the trap in the way that they've written this version of Poor Unfortunate Souls, which I am not digging. Because that is not the Poor Unfortunate Souls that Sherry Renee Scott deserves to sing and act. All right, so let's move into the additional music for the stage adaptation. Let's look at some of the stuff that's working.
Yeah, okay. So
I have a fair bit.
I have a fair bit as well. I really do. So, honestly, I really love the overture. I'm a little bit of a sucker for a classic overture. Oh, you did not like.
I have it in the negative. Not because I don't like an overture.
Oh, okay.
But here, you do yours, and I'm just gonna go right into my comments on the overture.
Okay,
on
great.
The negative side right after.
Great. I'm definitely a sucker for an overture. I love them. I think just the way, especially, you know, I'm just remembering being in the theater. The drum roll to open it up it just ups the stakes of the whole moment from the get-go. Like, you're here, you're seeing, like, the Little Mermaid on Broadway. I remember, like, it, like, that drum roll, like, knocked me in my literal chest. I felt mm-hmm. so much. And I don't, like, have anything particularly articulate to say about the overture. And I'm glad it's there. It didn't need to be there. They could have shot us right into the show. And I just think the thought of that and, like, the attempt to make this a very grand event was going mm-hmm. in the right direction. And I wish that there had been, like, more of that.
Little Mermaid comes to Broadway.
Yeah, like, we're, like, here. And that's how so many people felt about it.
Since we did Beauty and the Beast, yeah. This is what you've been asking for since that.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, no, I totally know what you mean. And I am a sucker for an overture as well. And I also think that this is probably the best orchestrated moment of the whole
show. Definitely.
I mean, in part because it has to be, because you have to show mm-hmm. off the orchestra. And this is the moment where, like, when I sat, I was like, damn, they sound good. This moment and Under the Sea, I was like, damn, they sound pretty good. But for me, I have it as a negative because it's good. But I would have rather have them just do the iconic main title sequence. I would have had bigger goosebumps from that. Like, I actually, and I know this isn't how, like, Broadway works, I would have rather had them go Fathoms Below and then do the overture in the same way that Phantom of the Opera does it, where and then let the orchestra play the main title sequence of Little Mermaid
as the
stage is changing and diving under the water. I want that version.
Okay. So other positives. Okay, some of these are mixed, like I said, but generally positive. So The World Above. I actually think this song is so beautiful. The tone is perfect. Perfect. Like, it's so, it touches my heart. And it's a great way to get us some Ariel as quickly as possible. I will say, the themes are, like, a little similar to Part of Your World. But what I will say is, this song allows us to shift Ariel's love of the human world being very much tied to Eric, like in the film, to it being because she feels the most like her true self when she is on land. It's subtle, but it just gives her it takes the focus away from the story being completely about the romance, which I enjoy. And then being able to have the song turned on its head during Triton's reprise of the song while he's destroying the grotto, I think it's a great device to highlight their completely opposing connections to the human world. This ties to a point later. This and Part of a Quartet is kind of all Triton gets, which is completely wrong.
Yes.
Completely wrong.
Yes.
The interesting thing is this did get replaced in the licensed version. So I would be curious to hear what Triton gets in this moment now. But if we were going to take anything and flip it on its head to give to Triton, this was a great choice. So nice.
Yeah. The World Above, I really like it as well, because I think it would be a wholly wrong decision to lead with Part of Your World.
We
need to have Ariel, like, pretty soon in the show. And if the first thing that Ariel was singing was Part of Your World, everyone in the audience would be sitting there humming and singing along if you're a kid. Mm-hmm. And everyone would actually be missing the point of the song and the character exposition that actually happens in Part of Your World. It would almost sort of just be like going through the motions. But now with this new song, a new musical motif to take us through the show, we can actually hear the character journey of Ariel and not just take for granted what we already know.
Yeah.
And the melody's beautiful and Sierra sounds fantastic.
Yeah. And she's just like in a moment of just like pure bliss. And it's nice to open on her in that as well. That's nice.
Yeah. We can let Part of Your World be its own thing.
Yeah.
But The World Above is going to be our Ariel theme that carries us through the show for her development.
Yeah. I have She's in Love on my list.
I have
don't
it too.
Love it. I don't love it by any means. And actually, the first time I listened through, and I've kind of always thought this, I'm like, do we need this? I'm not convinced, but it's a bop and it's like a fun musical style to have in there. I do have other things to say about the number of musical styles we also have in the show. But again, bookmark.
I have things to say about that as well.
So I don't really have anything to say about it. I did put it on the positive in that it's like, it's a fun song. It's an enjoyable song. Do we need it? I could live without it, but that's just me.
Yeah, I think it's a good addition because it's also the only time that we get to hear Flounder do anything. And Flounder deserves to do some stuff. And it's a nice moment in a show to sort of like give us a break from
Yeah, like, Ariel can go have a drink of water while everyone else takes it. Yeah.
Yeah, like we have moments of expansion. We have moments of contraction. This is a moment of contraction so that we can tell how far we've moved in the plot. So I think in that respect, like it's fine to be here. And in many ways, it feels like this is what we were trying to do in beefing up Daughters of Triton. And I'm just like, then just let's do this. Okay. We don't need to beef up Daughters of Triton if she's in love. It's coming later. And yes, it's a bop. Do I think the musical style is necessarily appropriate with everything else? I am not so sure. I also, I had, and you're probably going to kill me for this. I Want the Good Times Back as a positive because I kind of enjoy that song.
Oh my God.
I kind of enjoy the song.
No.
Because
I am shocked at you.
No, I kind of enjoy that because I mostly because we get more story about Ursula. And maybe if it's a different version of this song, or maybe it's a different song altogether that still gives us more backstory of Ursula, then I would put I Want the Good Times Back somewhere else. And I would have that in there. I think it's just I'm starved for backstory in on Ursula. And we don't get that in Poor Unfortunate Souls. And this is a song that Ursula gets that gives us backstory for her. And so I'm here for that. So maybe take I Want the Good Times Back as a song out of it and just put any song written for Ursula that explains her backstory.
Yes.
That is what I have a positive
All right.
for. Because
All
I'm
right.
like, I like that we're exploring the fact that she is trying to punish Ariel and Triton. Because in the movie, it sort of feels like Ariel's a casualty of chance in this whole thing. But I like this whole thing of like, her teaching a lesson of silencing her, the sort of like feminist spin that like foreshadows the feminist spin that happens at the end. I get why they're doing it. Do I think it's necessary? I don't know.
Yeah,
but
no,
I have it in here because I want Ursula stuff.
That's fine, but I have it. Let me jump over to the negatives when I talk about it then, because my first thing I say is it was definitely necessary in terms of plot and backstory for Ursula. I am with you. If we're going to flesh out the characters of The Little Mermaid in musical form, we need more from Ursula. This gives us a peek into her motivation, and it's more of like her getting her own I Want song, which I enjoy.
Yes.
And Poor Unfortunate Souls is not that. Listen, it was always going to be an uphill battle because Poor Unfortunate Souls is like impossible to top. It's an amazing song, but it also
it's the villain song.
Yeah, and it just gets right to the heart. It gets right to the heart of Ursula. Like nothing is extraneous. It's perfect. But there is something about this tonally that isn't quite either going in one direction, which is fun enough, or going in the other direction, which is sinister enough. I would have enjoyed her I Want song. I would have been fine with it. We know me being very dark and twisted. We could have even retained the very vaudeville feel of this song, but with the contrast between the sinister lyrics and the more cheery vocal stylings. I understand the thought process behind this style. It allows Flotsam and Jetsam to be backup singers, and it kind of ties into Ursula's very like showy, performative kind of thing. But this just isn't where I would have gone with the character. So again, this is like a kind of a different conversation. I will try to hold myself back. But I guess my instinct is to make her even darker and more villainous, especially since we will not be getting to see her turn into a gigantic sea monster at the climax. But even if we were going to lean into the comedy aspect of Ursula, my preference is not this like quippy, punny, funny. I would have liked more Hades-type humor that's really behind it. It's funny, but behind it, it's driven by, like, total just, like, malice and, like, hatred for everyone. And really, really? She just wants the good times back? Like, that's not good enough, like, motivation-wise for me. I get it. She wants a, like, disgusting wealth, exquisite sin. Fine.
Exquisite sin is like I love that.
Fine.
Exquisite sin. Give me exquisite sin.
Yeah, but it just makes perfect sense to me that the song was replaced, you know, for further licensing. And when I used to listen to this cast recording, I would skip it every single time.
There it is.
Sorry. Let's go back to the happy things.
I'm glad that we had the discussion because
this could be very we agree.
Well, no. Because I think that there are good things. You and I both latched on to the good things that are happening in that song. I let those good things be enough to put it in the positive.
Yeah.
And you use them as a way to be like, this isn't good enough. So, okay. Interesting to see where we land. Okay.
Yeah, it is.
All right.
Okay.
So we've done
Let's
She's
go back
in
to
love.
The good things. Yeah, the positives.
Yeah, good things.
Okay. We're about to get to my biggest good thing of this entire cast recording.
I think it's my biggest good thing,
her
too.
Her voice.
The best single addition to this show by far.
Couldn't agree with you more. I am so in love with this song. Okay. Let's start with the orchestrations. They sound like flowing water. And they perfectly echo Ariel's classic Oz during the intro. Excuse me.
Correction from before. This is the best the orchestra sounds in the entire show.
Yes,
not the overture.
Agree.
Best orchestrations, best arrangement.
Yes,
the
orchestra sounds so classic, romantic, almost like Lerner and Lowe romantic musical theater, which is my
and
favorite
And it
thing.
Sounds like it belongs in the film.
It does. It does. It belongs in the ocean. Oh my God. The build to the climax of this song is so dramatic.
It is an orgasm.
I can't talk about this song with you. We love it too much. I love that Prince Eric has such big feelings in this iteration because we do not get that from him in the film at all. He barely has any feelings in the film.
No, he's gay in the film.
Then, like, the theme of the song. I love that we have the prince pining after the heroine just as much as she is pining after him. It's exactly what we needed to make it feel like Ariel isn't just giving up her life for some guy who may or may not feel the same way as her. And his words are such a great play on the classic, like, sailor pulled in by the siren song trope, which I love. And this song just takes us to so many places that are just not predictable at all. The change at the end into strange as a dream. Oh my God, it's so haunting. And you can't hear it coming before you get there. It's so swoon worthy. And I agree with you, it's the best addition. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I love everything about it.
Yep. The musical stylings of this, I think, match the original film score more than any other song in this. It feels like a true extension. We get the characterization of Prince Eric that we desperately need. It's hauntingly beautiful, the way they bring in Part of Your World motifs into this song. The underscoring, it's a beautiful musical moment to show the match between Ariel and Eric.
Yes.
Like, because it's like he's singing his own thing, but she's underneath. And it's like they are a match. It works because we've got both of those musical motifs present in the same song together. The final phrases of this song, I think about maybe once a week.
Yes.
It's the perfect musical articulation of longing. And with how long they make us wait for those chords to resolve, it's perfect. No notes. That is a musical articulation of longing. That is what it is.
That's building out what we were missing from the character in the film. That's how you do it, to put it on stage.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Mm,
come set me free. Okay.
Okay. I
need a minute.
Coming down off that high real quick.
Okay. Again, this is a light and simple positive. Beyond my wildest dreams. I think that there's a reason that you'll hear this in literally every single audition room in New York City, even to this day. Again, we want to get a lot of different facets of Ariel here. It captures the youth and wonder side. It also shows off the more soprano-like colors of the voice of the actress playing Ariel, which I also love. I think, this is the only thing though, if this sat amongst two more additional songs for Ariel, I would like it even more because the frothiness could have some counterbalance in some other songs with more depth. This goes into a larger note that I have about this is that we need more songs from Ariel. But again, that's kind of part of my closing argument here. So
yeah, it does feel like there are moments where she just like disappears from the show,
which is unacceptable. I have my thesis about
it's called the Little Mermaid. She's the title character.
She's why we're here. Please, okay. I also enjoy One Step Closer. I love the use of the instrumental from Jig from the film. For me, you don't like that.
No, I have thought about that.
For me, it offers an immediate connection for the audience without most of them likely realizing that they know the melody already. The tune very much belongs to Eric and his seafaring world. It feels so him. It's a nice fit. This is a little bit influenced by me having seen it. This song offers a gorgeous moment of emotional connection between Ariel and Eric that was one of the most memorable in the whole show for me, seeing it live. There were just so many opportunities for touches and glances that I feel the music really supports. And the ending is just sweet as all hell. Again, it's the staging, but I just want to talk about it because this is one of my favorite moments. Just, it's something that stuck with me and I don't know why. At the end of the song, after Eric has taught Ariel how to dance, in the cast recording, you'll hear like an ending kind of like bell tone. And on stage, it's accompanied by Ariel curtsying to Eric, like imitating the way that he kind of bowed curtsy to her when he taught her how. And when he sees her do that, he kind of like steps back and puts his hand on his heart as if it just like her doing that just like struck him right in the heart. And it's one of the most lovely things that I've ever seen. And I think the music supports that moment.
Okay. I have a reason why I could do without this song. Should I just say it now?
Yeah, say it now.
One Step Closer, it's interesting because they taken a melody from the film that was in the score and they turned it into a song for Eric. And this worked with Home in Beauty and the Beast, which was plucked from the underscore.
Yeah.
In this case, I don't think this particular melody is actually meant for words. No doubt Eric needs another song in the show, probably in this moment, but the lyrics actually distract or struggle to live up to the iconic melody from Jig for me. Oh. Side note, Alan Menken is a boss at Folksy Fantasy Dance Music, and that can just stand iconic on its own. Like, this would be like trying to add lyrics to Kingdom Dance in Tangled, when it would be better to just make it a full-on instrumental dance sequence. In fact, I think Eric and Ariel's story would be infinitely more meaningful for them to connect in a dance sequence without lyrics to show how their love surpasses words or voice.
Okay.
I'm okay with him having another song. He needs another song.
He does.
I just don't think it's Jig. And if we're going to use this melody for dancing, just let them dance and connect without words.
All right.
Can you imagine if they tried to put words in Kingdom Dance?
I am dancing in the kingdom and I am dancing.
I would hate it. It would sound ridiculous.
Okay, that is fair enough. I hear you. This is another small one. I'm trying to race through because I guess I have a lot, but it's just small things.
I only have one more.
Okay, I've only got two more. So the Sweet Child reprise. Hear me out.
Okay.
I think... Sweet Child and the reprise, really. You can't have the reprise without the first one.
Sure.
I actually think that this is exactly how Flotsam and Jetsam should live on stage. Tight harmonies, songs that do not take up too much time, but are still menacing and chilling and move the plot along a little bit. I just think it's nice. I think we don't need any more from them. That was good.
Yeah.
It's tonally right. Like, that kind of slithery feel is what I wanted more of from Ursula, of like... slithery, but I'm gonna friggin' kill you.
It still sounds too bright to me. That's the thing. But let's do our last positive because I'm sure we both have the same one.
Obviously.
The If Only Quartet.
It's the If Only Quartet, which again, another, I think it's low-key one of my favorite modern musical theater songs in its own way.
There's a reason it has a star next to it on the album in Apple Music.
Yes! It's, okay. I love the dramatic tension of a quartet for four characters, each racing toward a climactic moment from very different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And there's just
You have Your Work and Nothing More in Jekyll and Hyde. This
is
very that.
The Tonight Quartet from West Side Story. Just please.
Yes. Give us a quartet.
And there was just no precedent in the film for a quartet or really even for a duet. And so I just think the fact that this was put in is friggin' brilliant. Like, thank you. What a gift. I think it's just such a brilliant choice. The lyrics from Ariel are so heartbreaking and exactly the kind of pathos that I'm looking for in her journey. When she says, "If only you would notice how I ache behind my smile," I think that's so sad. And also, if we're going to bypass the plot line of Eric being put under a spell, it's highlighting the fact that the obstacle that Ariel is up against here is just Eric's like human blindness to his true feelings. And in its own way, that's even more heartbreaking. It's like, dude, you're the only thing in the way of this working out. It's not magic. Yeah. It's just you, bro. Like, what's wrong with you? This song also gives us the much needed moment of regret from King Triton. He should have his own song. expressing exactly that.
It's Norm freaking Lewis.
It's Norm Lewis. And it's also just like King Triton could easily sing a song about just like struggling being a father, losing his wife. Like there's so many options. And then, you know, in the ending of the song, just one thing that always stands out to me is when Eric sings, end of the ball, what will occur? Maybe I'll find that voice, but I'll lose her. He holds her. And then the others overlap singing, if only, if only, if only. I think this song is just heartbreaking and I love it. It's exactly the kind of emotional stakes that we need the additional material to provide. And I just wish a lot of the other ones were at this level. I know that not everything can be a sad song.
Yeah.
But this is just so good. It's lovely.
Yeah, there's drama to it. And I think drama is necessary to all of the additions.
This whole thing needs more drama.
Not necessarily sadness or like ballads or anything, but just like drama.
And
like
drama.
It has to have dramatic merit to be here. And this does it because this is that calm, quiet before the storm moment before all the shit goes down. Unfortunately, all the shit that goes down is not the same level of shit that
this
we're
song
used to.
Is more dramatic than the shit that goes down after it.
Like, can you imagine if this song happened before the events of the film happened? Like, that would be like, whoa, like going into battle sort of situation.
Yeah.
But I think it's beautifully structured that Ariel and Sebastian are trying to figure out ways to sort of make this work out because they know the full picture and they share the same melody. And Eric and Triton, on the other hand, are singing about their longing for Ariel, different, of course, and they share the same melody from her voice. I just think the structure of it is really, really good. Really, really good.
And it's nice to see this side of Sebastian as well, the sensitive
side. Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. Because in the film, he can be kind of like just a...
Kind of
an asshole.
And when he says, like, he says like... If it were up to me, like, I would just wave my claw and make your dreams come true.
Yeah.
That is so... I love
like,
that.
He's very hard-headed in the movie. And, like, we see moments of his softness. But, like, I appreciate that we get to see his soft-shell crab side.
Yeah, soft-shell crab. Yes.
All right, let's hit the negative, shall we?
All right. Well, we touched on my big one, which was I Want the Good Times Back. But, Lord have mercy, human stuff. Okay. To start,
I noted that it's forgettable.
It actually makes me mad. It's more than that for me. I'm not personally someone who needs more from Scuttle. Why on God's green earth does Scuttle have two songs and King Triton doesn't have any songs?
I have the same thing. I'm like,
you kidding me?
Why did we double down on Scuttle and Flotsam and Jetsam but not King Triton
show? This song, okay, first of all, it doesn't propel anything forward plot-wise, and it is not funny or catchy enough to make a pause in the action this early in the show worthwhile at all. It's just way too early for a song with no point. Positivity is great because, fine, let's keep that one. It gives Scuttle, again, in the same way that, you know, that Under the Sea is used, it gives Scuttle a chance to encourage and uplift Ariel, therefore endearing us to him.
But, and that's the first number after the intermission, right?
Yes, and it's a tap
number,
which is necessary.
So it's kind of like a Hygge
situation. Yeah, we need people to tap at the beginning of Act Two. I'm so fine with that.
Get us back in it, yeah.
Yeah. I think this song speaks to a strange attempt to keep the attention of young audience members. And guess what? Ariel
they
is
weren't
enough.
There. Oh.
Ariel, oh, that too. But Ariel is enough, y'all. We don't need to keep them paying attention. Scuttle is not who the kids are here for. Children can appreciate depth and they can appreciate ballads. I don't like it when we play down to them.
Yeah. I just said like I lumped together Sweet Child, Human Stuff, and Positivity because I'm just like they're forgettable, largely annoying in my eyes. And I'm just like, it's just interesting the choices of the characters that we're really committing to with music. And I think the only reason I can sort of see as to why they're giving these moments to Scuttle or they're giving these moments to Flotsam and Jetsam is because they just happen to be in moments of the original source material that have the most potential to be ballooned up into a longer stage version. But there are characters I think we could have developed out more, and it feels like we just really went hard on Scuttle and Flotsam and Jetsam, and I didn't need it.
No. Also, just shout out to Eddie Corbitch, who is doing a great job as Scuttle. Like, fantastic.
Yes. Oh,
it is not him at all. It's just, he should have Positivity because it has a purpose. This has, human stuff has no purpose.
Yeah, he does such a good job.
Yeah, he's a great Scuttle. Like, great.
And it's another version, kind of like Titus, where it's like, he's giving us the essence of the character from the film, but not doing a carbon copy.
Exactly. Exactly. Which is perfect. And I feel like Scuttle's a tricky one, too. And he's great. He's great.
Yeah.
All right. And then my last negative is not tied to a specific song. It is what I touched on a bit before, which is that I think I would have liked a song from Ariel to close the first act. Now, bear with me.
Mm.
I saw the show. The act one closing visual is very stunning. Don't get me wrong. It's Ariel in her human form arriving on land. We journey from underwater back up to the land. It's very cool. But I think the overall thing I'm missing from this score is just squeezing as much music from Ariel as possible. On one level, she is like, I mean, we talk about other princesses' singing voice, but she is like known as a character for her beautiful singing voice. Yeah. So she needs to be singing all the time. Singing is literally intrinsic to who she is. But I just...
And Sierra has the stamina for it. She played Christine times?
Sierra could sing literally anything. She has so many different colors to her voice. But I know that this attempted to put a feminist spin on things, but a really easy way to do that, that I'm just tired of people not realizing, like, is just center her as much as possible in the story and in the music. Her journey needs to be the core of the whole thing. And she needed her moment to close the act. Now, granted, having her sing immediately after giving her voice away might have been tricky. Maybe it wouldn't have worked. But then in that case, maybe we move the end of Act One to a different point in the plot. I don't have all the answers. I'm spitballing. But Ariel needs more music. She should have the amount and variety of songs as like Elphaba and Wicked. We should hear every side of the actress's voice. We should be able to experience every facet of Ariel. It is literally why we're here. It's why all of the seats at the Denver Center were filled. It's why I was literally busting out of my like literal seat when I went to see this as a 15-year-old, because I was just like, I like am Ariel's age. I understand her. Like, I need this to speak to me. And she just doesn't get as much of an opportunity at all. We need more.
Yeah. My last couple negatives here are the finale lyrics are just, they're rough for the chorus. Yeah. I'm happy of ending it with Eric and Ariel singing to one another, but like, woof. And now at last, love has surpassed each tribulation. Mermaid and man finally can join and be one. Now they can smile walking the aisle here at their wedding celebration. I'm just going to leave that there. And then there are just many additional songs that are, some of them that are on my positive side that I like, but I feel like they're a stretch from or a departure from the musical stylings of the film. It's almost like this retro doo-wop thing and then like a vaudeville cabaret thing. And they're definitely derived from the presence of songs like Under the Sea and Poor Unfortunate Souls in the original film. Like, that's how I can see them justifying their presence. But at times it feels like we are really testing the boundaries of how far that leash can go, especially with Human Stuff, with I Want Those Good Times Back, She's in Love, in such close proximity to one another. And then Positivity there too.
Yeah, I feel you.
Do we want to do some overall thoughts on Little Mermaid?
Yes, yes. I feel like I've touched on them, so I will move quickly. I just want to say I have to pay tribute to the fact that I was like fully in love with this album when it came out. Like,
me too.
I bought the CD the day it came out.
On the school bus.
Oh my God, yep. I listened to it on the way to school. I remember sitting in my living room at the time and playing it like we could play it in the DVD player through the TV. And I just like laid there and let it wash over me. And I was so happy. And it was just very magical to me, and I have to just say that. But I think revisiting it, where it falls short is just largely that the wrong characters were given additional material.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've discussed as well, some of this material doesn't feel like a continuation of what The Little Mermaid sounds like. Like you said, the film does have a variety of styles, but there's this recording can feel disjointed at times. And I think that disjointedness blows some of the stakes out of the story. When I think of the way the film presented when it debuted, it had a level of sophistication and mystery that Disney animated films had not had up until that point. And although I know that this is an extremely tall order, I wish the stage show had up-leveled the material in sophistication and complicated it a bit, rather than what feels like a bit of a simplification, even down to the orchestrations, as we've discussed. Now, again, some songs really do this. Her voice and the If Only Quartet, I feel like they do it. And the vocals are overall spectacular.
Spectacular, yeah.
Spectacular. The performers are just, each of them is just adding something special to characters that we know. Like, they've all struck this really perfect balance of, like, paying homage, but also making these characters something new and unique. And I just wish the material had supported them a bit more in filling in the drama of a story that's very, it's a very high stakes story. This girl, like, sells her freaking soul and her voice for love. Yeah.
I mean, like, operas have been done about this.
Exactly.
This story. Like, which yes. is also why I was like, we have someone who has a background in opera directing this.
Mm-hmm.
And it just feels like the material wasn't raised to the level of someone who directs opera.
Exactly. Like, yeah. And it's just like, the film came out in the 80s. So when this came out on Broadway, kids who loved it were adults who were going to go see it. So I just wish that it was targeted less towards young children.
Sure, sure. I think this album is probably one of the Disney theatrical cast recordings that I've listened to the most, ironically. Same. So I was actually really excited when we were like, let's do Little Mermaid. And I would still say that the cast recording is very solid. Like, it was still, I got a lot of the things that I was looking for from this cast album. It delivers on the music that we're expecting to hear for the most part, gives us a good variety over the course of the track list. For the new music, it's clear that when they hit a good one, they hit it hard. But there are still a handful of duds that you have to listen to that I don't always think are necessary in progressing the story. Standouts for sure. She's in Love is a standout for me. Her voice, If Only Quartet, Titus Burgess's Under the Sea, Sierra Boggess's Part of Your World. I think it makes use of additional music in particular by giving us some moments of the story that were not in the original film, but feel important to the story and with characters that we might want to hear a bit more from. But I agree, we're not always focusing on the characters that we really do want to hear the most from. My biggest critique is that the musical stylings can just be so varied throughout it that it's making me ask, like, what are we doing here? Or even check out of specific moments because it's just so different. I would also say that while everyone sounds fire on their songs, everything, including the orchestra, sounds too bright. Part of that can be attributed to the orchestrations going hard on trumpets, brassier instruments, flutes.
Yeah.
But the result is that the music is lacking some real depth.
Yes,
and
yes,
I mean
yes, yes.
that in the actual sound, but it could also be said that we're lacking depth in tone and lyrics of the music itself. I feel like we're missing some of the layered complexity of the music that we fell in love with in the film.
Yes, exactly.
And that's not to say that there isn't any depth, but the general lack is what causes moments like her voice to stand out so much. There's complexity in the melody and the orchestrations. The orchestra is taking time to flex its muscles and swell and back down and feature solo instruments. It gives us so much to work with and make sense of as a listener and make us want to listen to it again. And I think the way that they did her voice is the approach that they should do for all of the other music of the show. Give us the depth. Give us the complexity.
Give us the complexity and the adult, like, multifaceted versions of these characters.
The theatrical deepening.
The deepening.
All right. That's Little Mermaid. I don't know what out of 10 I would give it. I would give it a number. Okay, so at this point, we're going to stick a pin in the conversation and we will pick it back up in part 2, which will be released. And that's going to cover Frozen as well as our final thoughts on the showdown. Until then, if you liked what you heard, please remember to hit follow or subscribe wherever you're listening to the podcast. Also, make sure that you hit 5 stars and leave a review so other people can find the podcast. Truly, if you're looking for something to be like, how can I help them? Write a review. That's the way. That's really the way. And it doesn't even have to be much. So yeah, we thank you very much for taking the time to just jot down a few words and send them to us in the review section.
Please follow us on social media as well. We are at Poor Unfortunate Podcast on Instagram and Facebook, and at Unfortunate Pod on Twitter. I mean, TBD, Twitter is a hellscape. We'll see.
Yeah, we will.
So please follow us on Instagram. That's the place. Again, that's another thing that just makes us feel good. Instagram is really tough, like trying to figure out the posts versus the reel. So a follow on there, a comment on one of the videos, it really goes a long way. So thank you to all of you who participate in the polls and are just around on the socials. And if you want some more Poor Unfortunate podcasts in your life, please join our private Facebook group, the Poor Unfortunate Fam, where our listeners discuss episodes, talk about their Disney trips, we take BuzzFeed quizzes, and it's just a way for Connor and I to get to know all of you a bit better. We also ask some questions in the fam about what people want to hear in upcoming episodes. So if you want your voice heard, that's the place to be.
And the Poor Unfortunate shop is open. You can go to poorunfortunatepodcast.com/shop to see all of our merchandise. If you have a friend or a family member who listens to the podcast and are looking for a gift this holiday season, some Poor Unfortunate merch is never a bad idea. The deadline for getting holiday orders in is December 12th, so make sure that you place your order before December 12th so that it can arrive in time. So go ahead, check it out. Check out some of the stuff that we have. And if you have ideas, if you're an artist who wants to do some art for a t-shirt or something, get in touch with us. We love to hear ideas and things like that. And the last thing I'll say is that it does take us a little bit of money to keep the podcast up and running and coming to you. We have a PayPal account. It's linked in the episode description and all of our social media bios. Truly, anything you have to spare goes a long way for us. You can make a one-time donation, monthly donation, $5, $10, more than that. It all just goes right back into the podcast, keeping it free and for the most part ad-free as well. So anything you have to spare, truly, we would appreciate it. And if you can't, we totally get it. It's the holiday season coming up. So wallets are tight. Even more, a review, a share, a recommendation, that goes a long way for us too. All righty. Well, this is our last episode before Thanksgiving this coming Thursday. So from both of us.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. We're so grateful
that you keep up with us. You continue to listen. You continue to participate and engage with us. It keeps us going. Every single thing that you say, we take to heart. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you for welcoming us into your lives. It means a lot to us.
Happy Thanksgiving. Hope you get to spend some time with people that you love, family, friends, whatever that might be. Alrighty. Until next time,
Beluga Savruga.